London Paul from the Sirius Report. Welcome to the Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for, you know, getting in touch. It's great that we get together again. It's been a while, and obviously we wish you all the best in your new venture. I'm sure it'll be immensely successful.
Well, as I feel sometimes, I feel like a broken record, but I truly appreciate that. I truly am humbled by all the support, not only from, you know, people that I've spoken to over the years, but also the audience that has made their way to find the new channel. And I'm really looking forward to this new chapter. But Paul, I think, you know, an interesting place to start today, we're going to cover a lot here, from China to Russia, a lot of these, you know, geopolitical situations. But obviously there is a huge part that I think gold is playing in this shift. And I think a lot of this is being really catalyzed by the East. So why don't we start by discussing how China really looks at gold, and let's say what their strategic vision is with gold at the becoming such an important part of their monetary system.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think let's start with a little bit of history, because China's love for gold came about a lot earlier than perhaps most people will understand. And I've said this publicly previously on several occasions. But back in 2012, for a period of 30 months, 1,000 metric tons of gold went from west to east, from basically various locations. Most of it ended up in China and some in Hong Kong. So simple math, 30,000 metric tons. And the love affair with gold really took off there with China, because China had had discussions with people I know, what I would call the architects of multipolarity, the ones who had the vision back in the 90s to say to everyone in the world, including the Americans who ignored them, look, you know, the US hegemony, the dollar, this financialization model is eventually going to fail, which of course it did in 2008, and they just tried to carry on and pretend it didn't. And therefore, the world is going to have to look at things differently. And part of a component of the multipolar world was to say, well, we need to have gold as a component of this. What does this mean? And people will say, well, you can't have gold-backed currencies. You can't, you know, we tried all this in the past and it failed. Well, just because something failed doesn't mean we repeat the same exercise. We do something different. And China really, since that point in time, and it kind of accelerated from 2014, which was around the time of the Ukraine Maidan, when that was a big wake-up call for the East, particularly not just for Russia in terms of what happened, but also for China. And that's why we had the Power of Siberia One, so-called Holy Grail Energy Deal, signed all in non-dollar terms in 2014, and it went live in 2019. And the rest is history in terms of energy, but that was another important component. And since then, and I've made this point since 2013, when people kept saying to me, well, when are we going to see a big shift in the gold price in terms of, you know, priced in dollars or euros or whatever? And I always made the point, you will only truly see it when the West is drained of gold. And that's not, or, you know, literally, but when there's no surplus gold anywhere. And over a long period of time, Chinese just kept buying up more and more gold. Not exclusively the Chinese, but many of the global South countries have been buying up gold very discreetly, some less discreetly, excuse me. And effectively, this has been an ongoing strategy now for 12, 13 years. And there was always going to be iterations in this process. And I've made all these points a decade ago. China would get to a certain point where it would have bought up everything it could get its hands on. And then there would come a stage where it's not as though there isn't any, they've drained the West, but there's going to be an opportunity to drain the West even more. And that came about when you started to have an arbitrage between Shanghai and London, New York. And that accelerated even more gold heading from West to East. And then, of course, we started to, in this year, and don't have people disagreeing with me, but in very simple terms, in a trade sense, China, because it wants to internationalize the yuan, said to all trade partners, look, it's very simple. We don't want to use the dollar anymore. We don't trust the United States. They've weaponized it. We don't want to deal with SWIFT as little as possible. Also, we don't trust the Western financial system not to properly collapse, which makes 2008 look like a drop in the ocean. So let's all get out of that system. We think gold's an important component of a new financial system. And part of that is, look, you trade with us. You can take your yuan, park it in the bank and buy stuff from us. Or if you don't want to and you just don't want to hold the yuan, well, here's the deal. It's fully convertible in trade surpluses into gold. That is the very definition in trade terms of a gold-backed currency. I know people will argue, but I'm sorry. That's like saying 2 + 2 = 4. And that was announced very quietly, very recently, in the context of other developments, which we'll come on to in a second. And that was another important component of this. Now, originally, China was proposing to do this in 2016, and the United States didn't particularly like the idea that that was going to happen and said, look, that's a declaration of war. Well, the world's changed hugely, and the United States is in no position to threaten China anymore for a whole bunch of reasons, which we can discuss as well. And therefore, this time around, there was no great fanfare, not a lot was said. And I put it out on a YouTube clip. I think a few other people have commented since, but it's absolutely another part of that component. And this is, so therefore, any trade partners who may still have concerns about the internationalization of the yuan because they fear capital controls or that the Chinese financial system isn't as open as obviously things are in the West, which is true, although that's changing. You know, therefore, you know, if you don't want to hold it, you don't want to trade in it, you can have gold. And this is why they started to develop vaults in Hong Kong. There's ones now slated to be opened in Switzerland, which is the European hub, the UAE, which is obviously West Asia, Middle East hub, Singapore, which would be Southeast Asia, and Hong Kong, of course, to service China, because Hong Kong is the offshore branch of onshore China. So they're the sort of major stages, and we've been in recent times, we've seen the arbitrage happening. Now, of course, we have seen these developments with respect to gold on a temporary basis moving to the US, and we can go on to that in a minute because that's a separate story. But what I will reiterate, I can't emphasize this enough, is there isn't some grand plan going on between the Chinese and the United States about repricing gold. There's no love lost between the two nations. China sits there and wants to cooperate, but it's also mindful that the United States is trying to stoke a problem with Taiwan and continues to do so. And it also tries to destroy China's economy and wants to wreck companies like Huawei. So why would China want to cooperate with the United States in that respect? There's absolutely no reason why they'd want to do it. And then there's the issue of, well, the United States can reprice gold, and we can discuss that in a minute, but what's the ramifications of it doing that? What does that mean in reality for the US and the US dollar? But there is no collaboration or cooperation between the two countries in any way, shape, or form. And the Chinese, I know, have said to me they find it rather bizarre that anyone would believe that because, you know, as they said, we are in a financial war of sorts with the United States and an economic war, and the US is trying to coerce the Asia-Pacific neighbors like Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines. It's not succeeding, but they're trying to create some kind of mini NATO there to face off against China and try and create problems for China, as NATO undoubtedly created problems for Russia in Europe. So from a Chinese perspective, that's the kind of very 30,000 foot view of gold. So gold continues to be important. They will want to set up gold hubs everywhere, including additional ones in China, and gold will be something that will underpin currency and international trade. And it's all about the Chinese internationalizing the yuan, but critically not being a world reserve currency, because nobody in their right mind wants a world reserve currency. And in this day and age, we don't need one. The US, I think, will be historically the last one. And people will look back in history and go, well, that was a really foolish thing to do. It ultimately blew up in their face very, very badly. Okay, it was to a large extent their problem in abusing that with sanctions and color revolutions and all this tariff nonsense and threatening nations and bullying them and trying to coerce them into doing as they're told. And that certainly didn't help. But in the end, it just doesn't work on the basis of trying to run an economy, have a world reserve currency, because ultimately it is going to blow up in your face. It's now blowing up in the United States' face very rapidly because, not least, de-dollarization is a reality. I know people will still want to believe it isn't, but it's absolutely the case. And if people don't want to believe it, here's one just fact that's irrefutable. When we had the pandemic and the United States printed trillions of dollars, why do you think they printed trillions of dollars? Because no one would buy their debt. I mean, that is the very essence and definition of de-dollarization. If you'd gone back 10, 20 years ago, everyone would have been piling in to buy US debt. No one wanted to buy it, so the Fed had no choice but to print it all. Because if they hadn't, the United States would have collapsed economically and financially. So that alone is one indication of why de-dollarization is a reality. So that in essence explains China's position on gold, and it will continue to be the case. And it's worth reiterating the point, as I've said previously, that China has around 40,000 tons of gold. And people go, no, they don't. Well, look, I'm sorry, I know to the contrary, and I know that's factually correct. And not least that China actually produces 600 metric tons a year, which is, and for at least 20 years, that's 12,000 tons. Add the 30,000 tons that went from 2012 for 2.5 years. I'm not saying they all stay, but there's 42,000 straight off. So my 40,000 tons is not an unreasonable assessment just on that basis. And that's not also how gold markets work, because they work, there's opaque markets. That's where the real gold shift. None of the data you see reflects any of that. And that's where the real tonnage changes hands. That's where the real market operates. And most people in the world don't know anything about the opaque markets. I'm fortunate to know it because I know someone who was a huge part of it. He's now passed away, very sadly. But so therefore, I am privy to that information. And that's where enormous things like 30,000 tons moves from west to east, and no one really knows about it.
Paul, how do we separate out that 40,000 tons? Like, I've heard that much of China's gold is privately held. Is there a big difference between privately held and publicly held gold in China? And how does the government see both of them?
Well, the government has actively encouraged its citizens for a very long time to buy gold. I mean, you can see images people put up about Shaobei gold market, where people are just piling in there every single day of when they're open, and they're actively buying gold. So they encourage their citizens to do this. So there is a large, significant amount that is obviously privately held by Chinese people. My 40,000 tons is based on the Chinese government, or the governance structure, shall we say, holding that. I'm not including the gold that the citizens hold. I think there is an awful lot more gold in the world than people realize. That doesn't in any way, shape, or form mean that gold's overvalued, because people always jump to that conclusion. This is not an equity that issues more shares and dilutes the share capital. It doesn't work like that in gold. So yeah, it's very important from a public perspective and a private perspective. And there's no way in any way, shape or form the Chinese are going to turn around to their citizens and say, "Don't worry, well, we're going to confiscate all your gold off you," because if they tried that, there would literally be a revolution in China and it would be the end of the government as it exists now. But, and they're never going to do that anyway, because that's blatant mistrust, and whether people like to believe it or not, the trust between the Chinese people and the government is the only reason why Beijing is still in power. If that wasn't there, they'd have long since gone. And again, people might find that impossible to believe, but it's true. And that's why China has made these massive changes in the last 20 years, 25 years, because the people expect it. And if they don't make those changes, then the Beijing government will not survive. It's quite simple as that.
I want to go back to kind of what you were saying. Give us a couple examples of what Western takes on gold that China finds very amusing.
Well, I think the issue is that they don't regard, well, not everyone, but a lot of people don't understand the difference between currency and money. They don't realize gold is real money. They don't understand why people in the West are sat there completely ignoring everything that's happened. I mean, 2000, the dot-com bubble burst. I mean, trillions of dollars were just vaporized then, and then we had 2008, and they've never fixed anything, and we've had crises that have been papered over with bailouts and who knows what else that's gone on, probably, which is why there is at least $100 trillion unaccounted for on the US balance sheet. So where was that spent and why? Probably to have huge bailouts. And this comes back to the recent statement where someone mentioned about the US having magic money machines in the Treasury that seemed to just produce money when it was needed to fill a hole somewhere. I'm sure they were really thrilled that that got stated, because it's factually true. So the Chinese are looking at all this going, well, why don't you encourage your citizens to buy gold? Well, of course, we know why. They don't want the citizens of the West to buy gold, because, you know, it comes back to this point again, and this ties in with repricing gold. If you suddenly said tomorrow that the Americans came out and went, we're repricing gold to $10,000 an ounce because we apparently hold 8,132 tons, which they don't, but let's assume they do. And that's just a drop in the ocean. What, $2.5 trillion? What, based on 37 plus trillion of debt and 100 plus trillion money unaccounted for and 250 trillion of unfunded liabilities, that's like me being $1 billion, $1 million even in debt and going to the bank going, well, here's 5,000. The bank goes, yeah, fine, we'll call it quits. You can just carry on mounting debt up and blowing up your economy and financial system. And if you price it at $10,000 an ounce, what does the world going to surmise from that? They're going to go, the dollar is no longer a world reserve currency. It's basket case currency. And if you want to accelerate the demise of the dollar, well, why not just reprice it to 10,000? Because that's a surefire way to make the global South countries really affirm their belief that the dollar's a spent force. Well, thanks very much for pointing it out to us definitively. And the benefits for the United States are minimal and very short term, and the long term, it's a disaster for them to do so. So China's aware of all this. They know what's happening in the West. They're also, and therefore their attitude is, why do you have such a flippant attitude towards gold? And we know why, because if gold is priced, and I was in some ways a little bit surprised how it's got to nearly 4,000 now, and we haven't seen far more institutional investors, high net worth types in the West looking to take a position. Some are, but predominantly still not the case. But that's because they believe in financialization. They believe in asset bubbles. They believe the dollar's sound. And the Chinese are looking at this going, you must be insane. How can you possibly believe any of that's true. So that's their philosophy and why they understood, based on conversation they had with friends of mine back in the late 90s, that it's over. You need to start positioning yourself for a new world. You need to resurrect the old Silk Road. You need to start taking positions, and gold is the way to protect yourself in the future. And, you know, for them, it's just a matter of course that is what you have to do. And therefore they'll look at us in the West going, what are you doing? Why are you allowing us to buy all this gold? Why is all this gold heading from West to East? And you seem very happy to dump it. And we're going, thank you very much. And you're not asking the question, why are you doing this? But this is just very much what you would expect to happen in the West, where people slavishly believe in financialization. They didn't see the writing on the wall in 2006, when for me, I sat there going, it's over, everything's going to blow up. No, that can't possibly happen. Well, it did. And then they went, but we fixed it in 2008. No, you didn't. You know, QE zero interest rate policy for more than a few months is game over. Eventually, you will destroy every facet of your real economy. And here we are, that's precisely what they're doing. So what is it that they can't see from the Chinese perspective about owning gold and protecting and preserving your wealth? It's just, I mean, it's like saying night follows day to them. And, you know, they look at it and go, well, that's just how the West behaves, and just leave them to it. You know, I mean, we've made our position very clear. They don't agree. Well, that's their choice, which is why they're now saying we need to put our foot down on the accelerator, get out of everything dollar denominated. Everyone needs to pull the capital out in the global South. You need to get your skates on and get out of all this as fast as possible. Because even if they don't sanction you or freeze your assets or whatever, you don't want to have anything tied up in that financial system when it blows up and dies. I mean, basically.
So, Paul, when we think about, you know, we've spoken a lot about gold. Does that extend this monetary idea? Does that extend to silver? You know, saving in silver, recognizing it as real money. You know, I had another conversation this week, and the guest shared with me this idea that the more that we go along this road, the less monetary and more industrial value that silver has. Is silver seen that way in the rest of the world too?
Well, I mean, look, I would put it in position it like this. Yes, silver is going to be an enormous industrial metal going forwards. It's why China and India, particularly the last 4 years, have been buying up obscene amounts of it. And they're now starting to admit, the state-owned companies, oh yeah, we hold 20,000 tons. There's another one, oh, we hold 10,000. And I would arguably say China has at least 100,000 tons of silver, maybe even more. India bought enormous amounts in 2022, 2023, and still are buying it, although there's a bit of a moratorium at the moment because they're having problems with silver entering via the ASEAN countries, which is a way of just avoiding paying duty, etc. So, but anyway, in general, that's been the principle. And China's stockpiling it for very obvious reasons, because there's a massive industrial technological revolution underway and they need the silver, which is why they build this enormous amount of solar farms all over China. They're even now looking at building one in space, which is going to come about probably a lot sooner than people realize. So they need it for part of their big new technology industrial revolution. So to deny that it has enormous industrial capacity, that would be foolish. And I think it's absolutely true. As the years go by, then the desire to have it as for industrial purposes is going to grow because it gets consumed a lot. Okay, as the price gets higher, then recycling becomes more of a possibility. While it was $20 an ounce equivalent, it becomes rather problematic to start trying to say, well, let's try and recycle silver. But a lot of it gets consumed. It's quite a finite resource. I'm not saying they won't discover new silver developments in the future in wherever that might be in the world, probably a lot of it in global south countries. I won't be surprised in the future if Russia finds enormous silver deposits somewhere, given they've hardly scratched the surface in exploiting their resources. But what I would say, I don't see countries like China all stockpiling it for because they see it as a financial, you know, metal or a monetary metal. But what I would say is there's Chinese people starting to buy silver, and I think they're going to be encouraged to do so because, in a way, it is a monetary metal for the people, or potentially a monetary metal for the people. And there are people in the West who buy it as well for that reason, and rather than necessarily buying gold, because it's more affordable for people. You know, you pay even an ounce of $50 or whatever it is now, is still a lot cheaper, than trying to say, well, I can't afford an ounce of gold. You know, maybe I can buy 5 ounces of silver, whatever. So I see it as a monetary metal for retail. Now, it doesn't mean in the future that countries like Mexico have enormous silver resources. They might decide to, in some way, utilize silver to peg their currency in some way. I mean, I'm not saying it will happen. It's a possibility, but I think it's less of a monetary metal on a sovereign basis. Gold clearly is, and this is why countries all over the world are buying up as much gold as they can accept. Of course, surprise, surprise, the United States, the UK, and most of the principal European countries, but some are. Poland's buying up. They've got a lot of gold. They've got a strategy. They clearly have got the head screwed on in that regard. But yes, I think the assessment of that with regards to silver is correct. And if nothing else, because it's a finite resource, so to speak, then the necessity of it becoming more and more of an industrial metal, self-explanatory, because technologically there's going to be more and more demand for it in the future. So I think at some point it will largely become an industrial metal. And therefore it stands to reason that it would, therefore, the market would effectively become more and more orientated that way. And, there's going to come a point, for argument's sake, and I don't deal in prices because that's not what I'm interested in, but silver might get to a point when retail go, well, I've had a good run with this, and I think now it's time to sell. And the question is, who's going to buy it up? I think there's going to be queues of industrials going, well, and they'll talk to bullion dealers who go, I'd like to place an order, and you just hold all this, and then we'll take delivery of it. And I think that will happen at some point. Not at this point in time, but I think that's inevitability, and that will also accelerate this drive towards it being definitely more so an industrial metal. But I'm sure there's some retail people who hold on to their silver because, and I do agree that it has monetary properties, and therefore, for retail, it's an ideal outlet, and particularly for people, as I said, who can't afford to buy gold.
Paul, when we think about, exactly in that vein of what you just said about taking delivery from bullion dealers, do you think that going back to this idea of the pricing power being shifted from west to east, does this make exchanges like the LBMA, for example, functionally irrelevant, let's say, within the next decade?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, my philosophy has always been, and having spoken to the Chinese about this, their attitude is that, these kind of institutions either have to shape up or they'll cease to exist, basically. They can function in the new world. There's going to have to be gold, silver centers, commodity centers all over the world in the future. And, if these markets actually play ball, then they can have a future. But if they want to persist in doing whatever they have been doing, which, and lots of people have lots of different opinions on that, then I think they're doomed. So the attitude is, it's like, a lot of us have reservations about the IMF, World Bank, those kind of institutions. If they don't shape up, they're finished. It's over. They won't survive in this new world. So my attitude is the same, that they're going to have to shape up and do things differently. And, you know, because otherwise, if they don't, people are going to look at the alternatives. And they're going to look at China, for example, with gold and say, well, here's the thing. It doesn't work exactly like this, but I go to the Shanghai Gold Exchange and I want to buy, you can't buy an ounce of gold, but let's just do it to keep it simple. I know that that's backed fully by an ounce of gold. If I buy the contract, it's backed by an ounce of gold. One for one, irrefutable, leave the case. And there's a lot of concern in the West. Well, that's not really what's going on. And hence why we've seen very clear examples of Germany going, can I have our gold back? And no, it'll be a while before you can have it back. You can have it in dribs and drabs. I mean, what does that tell us? I mean, it tells us that actually the original gold that should have been in New York wasn't. Where did it gone? Why had it been sold to someone else, et cetera, or whatever happened to it? So it's all about trust, and the future's going to be about trust. So if you can't be trusted, you're going to be marginalized. And I would arguably say this applies to the LBMA, the comics. I know there are people who feel that there's some big game going on to basically stick it to the LBMA, and this is, you know, part of this thing that's going on with the Chinese. And it's not. There's no desire. China doesn't operate on the basis, let's try and stick it to institutions. But if, you know, if institutions don't play ball, then their attitude is, well, you're doomed in the future. And I think that applies to all traditional markets in the West. And I think this is why we're starting to see evidence of those changes. Because, I mean, why, for argument's sake, did we see, for example, silver just never seemingly able at one point to in the last decade plus of getting over $30 an ounce? Then it was kind of get over 30, and here we are. It's, you know, one of, I don't know, I think it's 46, 47 when I looked the other day. And that is an indication those markets are now having to start to play ball properly, because in very simple terms, it comes back to when the West is drained of gold and silver, true price discovery has to happen. Because there's a lot of contentious views on this, but if we say, for argument's sake, for every ounce of physical, there's 150, who knows, ounces pledged to that 1 ounce of gold, silver. Well, the problem with that is if the demand becomes enormous, then what happens if suddenly you have huge demand and those 50 or 100 ounces contracts effectively for 1 ounce of physical, if 50% or 80% go, I want my gold or silver, and you're going, hang on, we can't do that. It's a force majeure, and then that's game over for them. So as the West gets more and more depleted, then the need to try and resolve those problems and iron out those difficulties in the West becomes more and more apparent. And I think that's why we've seen in the last 2 years almost, gold went from about 1800 to, well, you know, 38, whatever, 50, whatever it is, and silver, I was 20 something, and now it's doubled in price, basically in dollar terms. I'm not saying exclusively in dollar terms, but I think, and I've made this point, this is to do with, as much as anything, achieving or moving towards true price discovery in the West. I don't doubt China is a big player in this. And it's because China just keeps going, well, we'll just take every bit of metal we can, we'll take all the silver, we'll take all the gold, and we'll just keep buying it because we know why we want silver, we know why we need gold. And as the West becomes more and more depleted, then the ability to manipulate prices becomes more and more of a problem. And in the end, you know, what do you take that risk that one day you might have force majeure? Can you imagine if that was, for argument's sake, to happen? Yeah, the LBMA or COMEX, I mean, the ramifications would be enormous. So in the end, you have to start playing ball and changing. And this is part of what I said the future is, if you want to be part of this market, you're going to have to play ball, and you're going to have to operate on the terms that the rest of the world demands, because remember, the global south is the vast majority of the world. It's where all the vertical growth markets are. It's the future. You in the West like to think you are the world, but your economies are failing, your financial system's failing, your society are melting down. You're in no position to dictate anything. So this is how it's going to be, and we'll price things accordingly. And this is partly why China also wants to have more and more commodities priced in yuan. It's going to ultimately one day be the same, where Russia will price contracts in rubles, and people won't believe this and they'll go, this is impossible, it's nonsense. But for me, we will see contracts priced in rubles, and energy, etc., will be sold on that basis, not just what China does with Russia, for example, or Russia does with India, etc., but in a more broader sense, because that is how the future is going to be. And it doesn't matter whether we in the West agree with this or think it's nonsense. It doesn't matter what we think, because we're a small minority of people in the world. The rest of the world's moving on, doing its own thing. And so you could either be part of the revolution or you can sink into the abyss, your choice. But, you know, maybe it'd be nice for you to join the revolution, as it were, and be part of this new way of doing things, which, as much as anything, means financialization in the West, which has been there since the 80s, has to die. It has to end. It's the best thing that could ever happen to the West if we want to really start to fix our problem. Yes, it's going to create enormous problems in the short term, but the alternative is everything just blows up anyway. So why not do something to try and remedy some of the problems by making really tough decisions and going, well, unfortunately, this has to end. There's no way of fixing it. But in the long run, do we want to make, for example, as I've said, America a great nation amongst equals? Nothing would please me more to see it, because I think the world would benefit, the US would benefit, the US people would benefit. But we are so far away from that happening because the United States is not prepared to admit their empire is dead, even though the empire is now staggering towards irrelevancy. And really, it's going round now, begging the world, bail us out, give us money. China, buy $500 billion of treasuries. No, go away. They tried it 3 times in the Biden administration. It failed. And look at them now. They're saying to countries, you must give us money. South Korea, we need $350 billion and we want cash. Isn't that the biggest indication the US is capitulating? Of course it is. That's how desperate the US is. And while all this absolute insanity is going on and claims of all these financial deals with the Saudis, which are absolutely nonsensical, that's what the US is facing. Financial ruin. It is bankrupt. It's begging the world, bail us out, give us money. And you know, also give us money and let us spend it on what we want to spend. That's not how financial deals work. You know, you if you loan money, you want to know what you're giving the money for, what's the investment and what's my return on it, not give us your money and it's like paying tribute to Caesar. That's what the Trump administration's become, because the US is in such a dire financial position.
Paul, do you think that China actually wants the US to fail? Like, do they, you know, there's so many synergies between these two massive economies. Is this, you know, an outright wish that the US fails, or is this more so a strategic road that China's going down that leads to that possible inevitability?
No, China wouldn't want the US to fail. It might sound unbelievable. Some Russia doesn't want the US to fail. Look, if the US fails, it's going to have consequences. Now, you know, because the US was the hegemonic power since, you know, the end of World War II, that yes, there's financial ramifications. That's why let's extricate ourselves as quickly as possible out of the Western financial system. But there are far broader geopolitical considerations. It's in no one's interest for the United States to fail. The fact the United States is failing is an entirely different matter. So, but you know, if the United States continues to try and harm and damage China, then China will retaliate asymmetrically and cause the United States enormous amounts of pain, but they're not going to sit there and go, well, you know what, we could destroy the US, because they could have. They could have come out and a long time ago go, we're having gold-backed currency properly, or we're going to dump all the US treasuries, or we're going to take all these various punitive actions against the US. But when the US started trying to have a trade war in Trump 1.0 and started attacking Huawei, which has failed to achieve its objective, and then they thought, well, we can screw China over with this new tariff deal, and China went, sorry, what was that, 145%? Well, we'll put it on your import. Oh, heck. Well, we better back away from that, because we just realized we can't export anything to China on that basis. So hence why we now have the backing off, and the US going, well, we're making progress, and China's going, there is no progress. So now it's, China doesn't want to destroy it, but their attitude is, the US, you are destroying yourself, because you have bullied the world, and the world's got to a point, we've had enough, we're not putting up with this anymore. And, you know, one of the biggest mistakes the United States made, and this is whatever people think about Ukraine and the Ukraine war and Russia's role in it, the worst thing they ever did was to effectively freeze Russia's financial assets, to cut off Russia's central bank from SWIFT and all the other, most of the other Russian banks, and basically try to cripple Russia financially. That basically was the final wake-up call for the entire global South to go, well, we should have listened to you, China and Russia. You warned us this would happen. It has happened. And now we want to get out the dollar. We want to de-dollarize. We don't want anything to do with the United States. And this is why we've seen, you know, in Africa, all the nations rising up and saying, we've had enough of your neocolonialism, kicking all the Western countries out. And the world's saying, enough's enough. And that was the final straw, because the US made the fatal mistake of going for seizing a nation's assets and freezing them, or telling the Europeans to do it. As much as anything, Europe stupidly went along with it, which has been very damaging for them in the long term as well. That just makes everyone go, well, we don't trust you. We're not parking assets. We're not buying in the US. We're not buying any assets. We don't want to deal with SWIFT. So the US made a lot of really seriously bad errors of judgment, which is accelerating its demise. And China's attitude is, well, if you want to destroy yourself, we're not going to do anything to get in your way. But we don't want you to work with us on that basis. We like to have win-win cooperation. We think we can work together in our economies, and that we can do a lot to help you. And you know, and China could. China could go quite a long way to dealing with these mathematical impossibilities that means the US can't fix its economy, so to speak, and its financial system. But it's in no one's interest, ultimately. Only the West wants to see nations destroyed, because they don't care or think there is consequences for doing it. Well, look at the consequences of trying to destroy Russia and how it's blown up in their face and massively accelerated the demise of US hegemony. It's accelerated the demise of the US dollar, US Treasury complex, and how, of course, gold is now, as far as the global South concerned, is the reserve asset, not the US Treasury anymore. I mean, and the US caused all this. It inflicted massive pain on itself because it was too arrogant and ignorant to understand there are consequences for actions. But if, for argument's sake, Trump and Bessent picked up the phone to the Chinese tomorrow and said, look, we know it's game over, we're going to cut the bravado, can you do something? Can we work together? The Chinese go, yeah, fine, but we're working together on the basis of trust. And we have to first trust you, and you have to show that that trust is reciprocated. And but if you're going to start trying to stab the Chinese in the back, they'll quite happily reciprocate, but they will cause immense damage. So they will target, for example, soybean farmers in the US, where they basically have ordered no soybeans for this season from the US, bought them all instead from like Brazil, and it's killing the soybean farmers. So you have to feel immensely sorry for them. But China therefore says to, you know, I'm sorry, but your government caused this. They're trying to cause us maximum pain. So we're going to respond. And on the basis of responding, unfortunately, you're going to get caught away. And their attitude is you need to then make representation. Your government say you caused this, you're destroying our soybean sector as one example. But that's how China will respond. And it's rather like the US trying to destroy China technologically by going, you can't have any chip. Then it's, oh, hang on a minute. Yeah, you can have some NVIDIA chips, but only the ones we say. And then China goes, no, we don't want those. We're manufacturing our own now. So NVIDIA suffers as a result of this. And China's just now developing its own chip technology and making advancements the US thought was not possible for 20 years. And they're doing it in 20 weeks or 20 months. I mean, it's that rapid progress. And again, that's the consequence of the US making policy decisions. So, I mean, quite rightly, China will react and respond. But if the US hadn't done this in the first place, and I made the point, I wrote to the Trump administration when they were elected first time around and said, this is your opportunity to make friends with China. So China will help you to rebuild the country. And it could be a very good win-win relationship between the two of you. That's what you need to do. And for a blink in an eye, it looked like that would happen when Trump invited Xi to Florida. But very quickly, it descended into this farcical trade war. And China went, okay, that's your attitude. You want to play with fire? Well, you're going to get burned very badly. But you know, that's your fault, not our fault, because we can't sit there and not do anything in response. But they're strategic. And rather than just saying, we're going to tariff everyone with no idea the consequences and the stupidity of doing that, they target things very specifically. And they're already causing the US immense pain because the military industrial complex can't make any new armaments because they don't have access to rare earths and magnets. And that's solely down to China. And as you said before we came on, one of the biggest beneficiaries of that is the Russians, because that's going to inhibit the capability to rearm Ukraine in this ongoing war that's still going after, what, over 3.5 years.
One of the things we've kind of touched on peripherally here, Paul, is the idea of the treasury markets and the debt markets, both in the US and China. And I find it so hard to not necessarily make my mind up about China, but you know, there's so much misinformation or disinformation, whatever, you know, new term you want to call it, but there's so much interference from both sides as I see it. How do you see the health of the bond market in China, and maybe contrast that to the US? As you mentioned, you put out a video, I believe in November of last year, saying that the US, it's mathematically impossible for them to grow their way out of this debt. So if you could contrast the two bond markets for us, please.
The thing is, on the West, it's so ironic, the West sees yields falling in China and tells us that's because China's imploding. And it's not. China is not imploding. The point is, China's bond markets are now becoming internationalized. There are Westerners buying into it in increasingly large amounts. There's a lot of international support for those markets, and the Chinese bond markets are in a far more healthy state than the US. And something people don't realize is China didn't go in 2008 end up with massive printing QE. They didn't do it. They didn't financialize their economy or their financial system effectively. And therefore, China is in a far more healthy position with regards to its bond markets. And correspondingly, huge amounts of money was pulled out the US. There's been capital flight out the US, and that a lot of that money is now ending up in China, not exclusively. Ironically, some of it's ended up in Russia, which is why the ruble was the strongest currency in the world for, I think, the first 7-8 months of this year. Because, oh, sanctions, what sanctions? You know, if we're the US and we want to invest in Russia, well, here you go, have our dollars. And you're very grateful that you're in receipt of them. So I contrast that with the United States. And in terms of US debt, in the first 11 months of the financial year, this year, 2025, the deficit, well, to all intents and purposes, is $2 trillion. In August alone, the deficit was about 350 billion. I'm rounding figures up because I'm not going to bother being that specific. It's a bit anal to do that. That's what, 7% of US GDP. So the US government is never going to pay down its debt. It's going to have to roll it over endlessly. And in the next 6 months, it has about $9 trillion that has to be rolled over. And they're going to, of course, keep borrowing more and more because deficits keep increasing. Even though Doge, remember the Doge that no one ever talks about anymore? And it didn't really save anything, but of course it never was going to do so. So who's going to buy all this debt? Foreigners? There's all this idea of foreigners buy. People are telling me the Caymans is full of foreigners. No, it's not. The UK is full of foreigners buying. No, it's not. Is the Fed going to end up buying it? Well, that's a distinct possibility, but at the moment they'll try and force banks and money markets to buy it. But the problem is when the issuance is enormous, which it's going to be, demand and supply just don't balance. So you're going to inevitably, like when the Fed comes out and cuts interest rates, the yields rise and the yields will continue to rise whether or not they cut rates or not. And as a consequence of this, I think you're going to start to see investors demanding higher and higher premiums, especially at the long end. Why? Because there's far more implied risk than holding at the short end. That's just a statement obvious. And the premium's very high. And what that tells us is investors see major problems inside the United States, particularly because no one's got a clue what the Trump administration's doing. There's obviously concerns about an economic downturn. There's all the geopolitical instability. There's inflation. And clearly, if you hold at the long end, it's going to deem to be a lot riskier than the short end. But I think you'll start to see yields will rise across the whole curve and is going to raise the cost of government borrowing. I mean, just look at, I think, August this year. I think interest payments is about one third of tax revenues. I mean, and ultimately, if you have no foreign buying, there's going to come a point when the idea, the Fed's notionally running QT, they're going to end up going back to QE. And therefore, for me, the United States is in this very dangerous, precarious place in its debt cycle. I think it's only going to get worse. And look at what's happening, where there was over $2.5 trillion at one point parked at the Fed in the reverse repo. The reverse repo is nearly at zero. They're starting to see indications of people nibbling in the repo market. I think there are liquidity problems in the West, not least because huge amounts of money has started to move out of the United States. I mean, we had US companies going to Europe to raise debt. They didn't use the US markets, they went to Europe instead. I mean, you're seeing things that are pretty unprecedented. And therefore, I think the liquidity problems, for a variety of reasons, is only going to get worse. And as it gets worse, then I think the risk of a repo crisis increases. And when you look at the state of the Chinese economy compared to the US economy, the Chinese bond markets compared to the US, their debt, and people talk, oh, China's got huge debt. People don't understand internal debt is not an issue. It's like people telling me Chinese banks are going to collapse. I'm going, you do realize they're state-owned banks. Tell me exactly how a state-owned bank is going to collapse. It's not, it's impossible. Even if it was going to happen, which is not going to happen, it's not. The Chinese just will go, we'll sort the problem out. Internal debt's not a problem. Chinese external debt's minimal. The United States has the reverse problem. So you comparing the two, the US is in major problem. I mean, look at China. It runs an enormous trade surplus with the world. Its economy is growing, where, and people say it's all fake. No, its economy is growing at 5%, but they underreport their growth and have done for 10, 15 years by about 30%. Why? Because they want to keep the yuan weaker. They don't want a stronger yuan at this point in time. That might change in the future. And in fact, ironically, there was this big idea that the Chinese will have to devalue the yuan. And now, no idea where that crazy idea came from. And in fact, China's starting to allow the yuan to strengthen against the dollar. And there's a very, very interesting development that I don't think I've seen anybody report. We've reported it in terms of my own podcast, not on in terms of YouTube, because obviously there are two different facilities. But essentially what's happening is we're starting to see in countries in the global south that their currencies are actually moving in tandem with the yuan, not the dollar. That includes like the Thai baht, the Malaysian ringgit, Chilean peso, Mexican peso, Brazilian real. They've moved almost in lockstep. And actually, China's doing the reverse of what all these experts said, and they're allowing the yuan to gradually appreciate against the dollar, because the yuan is now a primary currency for many Asian countries. Why? Because China's their major trading partner. It's all part of de-dollarization. And this foreign exchange policy is working across many emerging markets in the global south, but their influence also extends into commodity-linked economies that are impacted by Chinese trade flows. So there's all this kind of thing going on with emerging market currencies. And remember, when interest rates rose as they did in the US, the expectation is the dollar would have become immensely strong and it would have crippled these global south countries. That never materialized. And it's caused immense consternation and puzzlement in the West as well. Why didn't it happen? Part of the reason they raised interest rates was to try and get everyone back onto the dollar by going, well, if we blow all their economies up, then they're going to come begging us for dollars. And then they go, why is it not happening? Well, because huge parts of the world aren't trading in dollars with each other anymore. So it doesn't impact them in any way. And that's the part where those who don't believe de-dollarization is real are just not understanding what is really going on. So if you strengthen the RMB and these currencies I've mentioned appreciating in lockstep, that's hugely beneficial for those markets. Also, is driving this broader push by Beijing to internationalize the yuan. And they're taking advantage because the world's going, well, what's all these ridiculous tariff policies and all this exceptionalism and, you know, trying to bully us? And no wonder the global south's going, we don't really want to bother with the dollar anymore. And if you have a strong yuan that supports these currencies in the emerging markets, it also works for local debt. So if you have a structurally strong yuan, it reinforces de-dollarization. So China wants to. That's the one thing I will say. They kind of go, well, we're not really de-dollarizing to attack the United States, but they know full well that de-dollarization is going to have a massive impact, but they're doing it to protect their own interests because they can't trust the United States not to try and do something harebrained. Maybe they will try and seize all China's assets or freeze the PBOC out of SWIFT or whatever. So this is another example of de-dollarization. Also another example of how the yuan as a currency is in the ascendancy. Okay, it's not going to ever be a world reserve currency, as we said. It's not going to suddenly be utilized by 50% of the world tomorrow, but it's an emerging currency that's in the ascendancy. The dollar is in decline and rapid decline. So the difference between China and the United States in that regard is very, very appreciable, and it's very obvious. And it's another example of a country who is in the ascendancy, not, as people in the West like to believe, as opposed to the US, which in every facet of its economy, its financial system, the dollar, the US Treasury market, is in enormous decline. And, you know, hence why, you know, there's the whole subject of the mathematical impossibility for the US to fix everything. I don't know if we've got time today. Maybe that's something to talk about in the future. But there's a big, huge piece that very eloquently will explain in simple why the US can't keep the dollar as the world reserve currency. It can't run really high interest rate. It can't reduce the trade deficit or its budget deficit. It can't cut taxes and it can't do all these things and reindustrialize. And magically, it all hangs together because the simple maths, and we can give examples that demonstrates why it's absolute nonsense. And, you know, it's great to sit there and say to everyone, we can do this, or sit there and sound like very patriotic about the United States. Look, I've got a solution. I know how to fix this. Well, simple maths proves you cannot do this. And because if you think you can fix one thing, when you have financialization, you're going to blow 10 other things up. And you're never going to fix the one thing you thought you could fix, because when you blow the other 10 things up, you're going to blow that up as well. So accept you have to start from ground level. It has to be a whole new way of doing things. And then the United States will have to spend 5, 10, 15, 20 years regaining its position and building trust and having to go through a very, very difficult period. But this is the big difference as well. China works on the basis that we are building a nation for our children and our grandchildren. That's how every generation thinks. In the West, not just the US, we all care about what's in it for me now. Why want instant gratification? What do I get from this? And that's why the West is doomed, because that's all we think about, where China thinks long term and builds for the future. And that's why it's making the strides forward it is, and why the West is capitulating, because we don't care enough about the future. And we just care about today, and with no thought or consequence for our actions, and why you cannot fix the problems we have, because they're too fundamentally ingrained inside the Western economies. I mean, our cost matrix is totally prohibitive on every level. We cannot compete, and this is why you've got Western finances going to China, coming back and going, forget it. We can never compete with them. We can't compete with them economically, financially. We can't compete with them technologically. I mean, the simple fact is, if we're going to produce a widget for $10 and they're producing it for $1, who do you think the world's going to trade with? Us or them? And do you really think it's sustainable for us to produce widgets for an internal market where it's at $10 a throw? I mean, and never mind, obviously, we're going to inflate our debt away, or we'll just run it at 6 and 8%. Tell me how financialization copes with that. It will blow the financial markets to pieces. It will destroy the real economy. And it is totally unsustainable to do that. And how can you cut the debt by inflating it away when all you're doing every year is actually increasing the budget deficit? So if everything costs more, and you're having to raise more and more debt, and you're having to pay higher and higher yields, then the interest payments will balloon on that debt. So your debt pile will get bigger and bigger. So you're not going to reduce the budget deficit, and you're not going to reduce your deficit. It's just going to grow and grow. And that's just simple math. And there is sadly no other way around it. And I know people are not going to be happy me saying this, but I don't want this to happen. But this was always going to happen, and why I wrote to Western governments when they announced we're going to do QE and zero interest rate policy. I said, do it for more than 3 months, or as a quick fix. You then have to normalize rates, etc. If you don't do this, you will end up destroying your economies, your financial system. You will blow everything up in totality. Now, of course, I didn't get a single response, but here we are. Admittedly, 16 years or so later, but that's reality. And of course, they've done everything by bailing everything out and printing trillions and trillions to stop everything blowing up in 2020 during the pandemic, et cetera, et cetera. But you can't do it. It's a short-term fix. Once it's in place and you have financialization on steroids, it's over. Because you cannot grow a real economy, because you can't make the difficult decisions with that real economy, because financialization now depends on ultra-low interest rates, endless access to cheap credit, and that is just simply unsustainable for the US to do that anymore. So slash interest rates, Trump, or the Fed, run inflation at 6, 8, 10%. And watch how long it takes before the entire house of cards collapses. And it won't be very long. because anyone who understands basic, forget economics, basic maths, will know that is a completely unsustainable position, given the enormous debt pile as well that already exists and is only going to continue to grow, as one example. And, you know, if you want to talk about reindustrializing the United States, well, here's the problem. You're going to have to spend enormous, tens of, probably a $10 trillion to make the United States have the infrastructure to support such a measure. And even if you can raise that money, which is highly debatable, who's going to buy it? The Chinese? No, they're not. Who else in the world? No one. Well, let's assume you can do that, and then you want to reindustrialize the US, and then you start producing these widgets, as I said, and the widgets, five times what the Chinese produce a widget for. You can ban Chinese widgets coming into the US, fine. Well, you're not going to have an export market. And all you're going to do is actually produce these widgets internally, which will create massive price inflation. And people go, well, people will buy less goods. Well, considering the US economy is massively dependent currently on consumption, you kill the consumption market, you wreck the economy. If GDP starts collapsing, guess what happens with financialization models? They all collapse as well. And when they collapse, then the whole asset bubbles will burst and the United States will implode and the rest of the West will implode. And that's, again, why this fictitious financialization of economies is going to have disastrous consequences, because it totally cripples the real economy from ever being able to achieve the objectives, which is why China succeeds, because it has a real economy. It produces stuff and sells it to the world and sells it domestically. And it buys up assets in the world that benefit the Chinese to have those assets. And it doesn't have financialization. And it's deflated its stupid property bubble it should never have had, because it made the correct decisions. It was able to do that, because it took the tough decisions and did it very gradually in a way that was manageable. And no, Evergrande didn't sink the Chinese financial system, as everyone was very keen to say. I mean, what, no one talks about that anymore because it's an embarrassment, because it was never going to happen. But that's the big difference. China has a real economy, and that real economy is what drives policy decisions in the West. Our economy is a real economy, is irrelevant. What drives policy decision is, what are we going to do to stop the financial system imploding and blowing up our financialization world of massive asset bubbles, so we can go around telling the world that we have huge amounts of wealth. You have no wealth, it's paper. And when the paper implodes, all these multi-billionaires are going to be worth precisely next to nothing. They don't have real wealth. They have wealth tied up in meaningless paper. And that, in a very long way, explains why the difference between the Chinese market and the US market, and by extension, the rest of the West.
Paul, you paint a very succinct picture of, in some ways, recency bias and hubris by the West. Do you think that also extends to the ability of the U.S. to keep projecting power abroad here?
Well, yeah, they're projecting it for the domestic consumption. It's to make people believe in the United States that we're still top dog. We're, you know, numero uno. We're the global power. The rest of the world doesn't believe a word of it. They see reality. They see the United States getting kicked out of Afghanistan. They're seeing the United States unable to defeat Russia, by even though they threw the kitchen sink at them and it failed completely. They're seeing how the United States is basically all over the world is being unceremoniously becoming more and more irrelevant. They're losing relevance rapidly also in the Middle East. And look at what happened, the embarrassment in the Red Sea with the Houthis. They begged the Houthis, please stop sinking our ships and causing us huge acute embarrassment. If you do, we'll stop sanctioning you, blah, blah, blah. And they just turned around and went, we're not interested, go away. business as usual. The United States militarily is a paper tiger. It cannot fight a war anywhere in the world. And if people don't believe me, go and read the recent GAO report. It came out in August. It's not, there's a heavily redacted version. In some respects, there are things that couldn't be put in there for national security reasons. That's fine. But there's a public version. Go and tell me that presents the United States as capable of fighting any war. And the answer is absolutely not. And the rest of the world knows this, but the important thing is just to keep people in the United States believing in hope that one day somehow they can turn all this around. And this mathematical impossibility I've presented is we can do it. I mean, I've had enough dealings over the years with Americans in business, et cetera. And there's, you know, people used to say to me, you've got to have a can-do attitude. And I went, well, if you're telling me I can do this by, you know, sticking my head in a gas oven, then I'm not doing it. That's not a can-do attitude. A can-do attitude is we can do this and make it work. It's going to be really tough, but we can do it. The US attitude is, oh, we'll just do it and somehow it'll magically work. And we didn't think of the consequences of what this would mean. And the rest of the world understands this, except the Europeans. Britain's a long since failed. I mean, it was a failed empire at the end of World War II. It still harbors some delusional attitude that it has relevance. It has no relevance. So the West can believe what it wants to believe. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter anymore because the multipolar world's the future. Unipolarity is dead. The US can sit there and project its power to its minions in Europe, its minions in Japan, South Korea, etc. But the rest of the world doesn't care. And why should it care anymore? And this is why they're emboldened and aren't frightened of the US, because there's a collective approach from them that says, well, we can deal with these problems. And they will deal with, but yes, the US will continue to try and, you know, project its faux power around the world and try and convince its allies, because it forgets that the rest of the world exists. It doesn't think that world exists. It doesn't believe it's the world. It only thinks it and its satellites are the world. The rest of these are just irrelevant nobody countries. Well, they're rapidly understanding that China and Russia are far from irrelevant. And in fact, collectively, their relationship and what they're doing globally is a huge problem for the United States. And they can do nothing about it, not least because they're both massive nuclear powers. The US cannot go to war with a nuclear power because that's World War III and the world ceases to exist. And even the most very, very bizarre, strange people in Washington don't subscribe to that future because they know it's game over. And even if they survived, who would want to survive in a country that was completely destroyed? How long would you survive in a country completely destroyed? That's the other question. So in essence, that's the problem the US faces. And so, you know, they can sit there and the Trump administration is very good at projecting all this faux pas. But do you know what? Privately, even elements in Europe, when they disappear, go, what are they talking about? We just know this isn't real. No, this is not how the world is anymore. And certainly the US can start throwing its weight around, disappear. I mean, the G20 is a classic one where all the global South countries and the G20 all wait for the US to leave the room and go, okay, well, what are we going to actually do now? Work together now the US has disappeared and, you know, it's thrown its weight around, thrown its toys out the pram, and now we're just going to get on with real business.
Paul, do you think another way of kind of crystallizing this difference in ability to project power, ability to defend or even act offensively as well, is, you know, illustrated very well by the fact that I believe it's both China and Russia alone and independently are outproducing all of NATO in their arms. And how much more advanced are their, you know, their weapon systems as well than the US?
No, light years ahead. I mean, Russia's been light years ahead for a long time. And back in 2018, due to made a speech to the Duma and basically told the world, they told the world, we have all this technology with hypersonics, etc., and it's all coming out. And the United States, when they heard it, basically, to use a crude term, shat the bed, because they went, oh my God, they have technology we don't even possess. They have a modern nuclear arsenal. They have, they've been developing weapon systems on the fly during the Ukraine war, and they developed technology they showcased in Syria when Assad was still around and Russia was working with Assad in dealing with ISIS. They saw technology that scared the hell out of them. I mean, we're talking about high energy weapons, the vaporized tanks in a blink of an eye. So they were worried enough about what Russia's got. And because the West has no answer to any of this technology, and now increasingly seeing China with sixth generation fighters, with hypersonic weapons, and now they've developed this global defense system, which is unique. No one else in the world's got it. Basically, it's the Golden Dome that actually operates, as opposed to the US version, which is lots of talk, lots of banding big figures around, but is there any development? By all accounts, the people running it have said no, there's nothing, nothing's happening. But that's the US all over, talk big, project lots of massive figures and think the world believes it. No one believes it. So militarily, the United States is vastly inferior to those two countries. And this is why the US can never and is determined not to cross the real red lines with Russia and Ukraine. And it's very, very nervous about crossing red lines to do with Taiwan and China, because they're both nuclear powers with modern nuclear arsenals. The West has decrepit weapons. I mean, the US spends enormous sums of money just making sure their nuclear weapons don't detonate in silos. They're not even sure they can launch those weapons without them detonating in silos. So not that I'm saying we're going to have World War III. I've been very adamant it's not going to happen. But the US militarily cannot compete on any level with China and Russia. I mean, and the Ukraine war's proved that. I know people have very different opinions about the war. This isn't about me condoning anything that the Russians have done in any way, shape or form. But the plain simple fact is that Russia is, as every bit of technology that's a game changer that the US and Europe's given, have all failed in totality, because they're not game changers. The Russians and the Chinese have game-changing weapons, and we in the West don't have hypersonics. We don't have sixth-generation fighters. We don't have a modern nuclear arsenal. And even in areas like submarine technology, where at one time the US was the leader, they've caught up the Chinese and the Russians. They have comparable and arguably better technology. So the US can't fight a conventional war. The GAO report demonstrates that. That's an American written report. And they certainly can't fight a major war against powers like Chinese and the Russians. They might be able to go in and try and fight the Afghans or the Taliban, and they spent 20 years and $2 trillion, and then they got kicked out and told never to come back. That's the US record. But look at what happened in Vietnam. I mean, this was back in the 60s, 70s. They lost that war. People say they didn't. They did. They lost the war. And because they couldn't fight conventional wars even back then. So all this faux projection of the US's power in terms of its military is just meaningless work. Everyone's seen what's happened in Ukraine and gone, you are nowhere near what you claim to be. And the West should be very, very worried about provoking Russia too much, because Russia has the technology. And look at those Arashnik. They just produced that. That was a weapon that was customized from something else. And that did really deeply worry the West, because they went, where did that technology come from? That was a pretty formidable weapon that they utilized on one occasion to make a point to the West. We have technology. We can fight a proper war, not a special military operation. But we have to hope that never happens. Because if it does, the devastation in Ukraine will be horrendous. And people need to accept that's just reality. This isn't about defending anyone. I hate war. I don't want anybody to die in a war. I wish the Ukraine war had never happened. But it's happened, whether we like it or not, for reasons we can agree with or disagree with. We are where we are. The war has to end. And the sooner it ends, the better, because the longer it drags on, the more Ukraine is going to suffer and the more its country is going to be completely destroyed economically, financially, and who knows in the end how many Ukrainians will die as a result of this. And people say, well, Russia should never have invaded. Well, okay, but they have. And the fact they have, and they're fighting the war and they're winning the war, is irrefutable. So what do we do? Just be pig-headed and go, well, let them keep winning the war, let them keep destroying more and more of Ukraine and killing more and more Ukrainians. For what purpose? Just to appease our hatred of Russia? Sorry, that's not a reason to justify why we're continuing to do what we do. It's unforgivable from my perspective.
How close, like, do you think that nuclear war or some type of nuclear strike, obviously that evolves into war with Russia, how close do you think that is to happening?
It's never going to happen. Seriously, it will never happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reality is, what, let's just assume it happens. So let's just assume, for argument's sake, the Americans go for broke and go, right, let's just start a nuke in Russia. Well, let's assume their missiles even reach Russia, which is debatable. Russia's air defense systems, they have not just S-500s, they have S-600s, they even have S-700s, which someone accidentally let slip, but was probably told to just mention it a few years ago. So let's assume their weapons get through and cause devastation in Russia. What do they think is going to happen to the United States and its allies? The Russians have made their position very clear. We have no way of intercepting any of their nuclear technology. So Europe will be vaporized in 5 to 15 minutes, literally. All the major cities will be gone. And arguably, if they use the, like the Sarmat, for example, as I said, that can destroy a country the size of France in totality. That's the extent of these weapons. And never mind what weapons Russia may possess, we know nothing about. I'm not trying to say that to scare people. I'm saying it's a possibility. The United States will not survive a Russian nuclear attack in any way, shape, or form. So no one's going to be allowed in that situation to go, let's go have a nuclear war, because someone somewhere is going to go, you do realize that's the end of our country as we know. There won't be anything left. The entire country will be reduced to dust. So is that an option? And the answer is absolutely not. So I will say with absolute 100% conviction, we will never see a nuclear war in any way. I know a lot of people will go, oh, you can't have that conviction. I have that conviction because I understand enough about the attitudes on both sides to avoid such a conflict. And I'll give just an example. When people are talking about it, it even is less likely than not happening to happen, if that makes any sense. But there was a situation going back in 2017 where there was a big problem with North Korea, and it could have escalated into a pretty nasty conflict. It didn't. It got sorted out because the Americans and the Russians talked to each other, and it all disappeared. What's the one thing? Did you hear anybody talk about it? No. And that's the point with this. When everyone's talking about war and World War III, it's never going to happen. And I'm not saying it would happen if people stopped talking about it. But I mean, it's just something that drives fear into people. And I'm totally with people on that. Trust me, if I thought for a minute it was going to happen, I'd be extremely worried. Not least, I have a 4-month-old daughter now, who, you know, I have to think even more differently than I would have done prior to her being born. So we all have a lot of reasons to be very concerned about things like that. But no, I really don't see it happening, because there are enough sensible heads on both sides who will never allow it to happen. And those people who are always gunning for war, I mean, look, they've made careers out of coming out with these statements. But what's the one thing? They make statements, but has anyone ever acted on them? Absolutely not. I mean, so the United States has got no intention of going to war with Russia. If it wanted to go to war with Russia, it wouldn't have waited 3.5 years to have done it. It wouldn't have gone out of its way to every day tell Russia, no, we know that wasn't you. No, we're not giving them these weapons. No, we're not doing something to cross red lines. I mean, that, and, you know, it's rather like what happened with the Iranians. Everyone says the US wants to go to war with Iran. Well, October the 7th is coming up in a few days. I'm still waiting for this idea the US is going to war with Iran. And when the US actually sort of didn't go to war, but they had this bizarre thing where they cooked up a plan with the Iranians going, look, we'll pretend to bomb your nuclear facilities. We'll tell everyone we destroyed them. And you know what? Just to keep everyone happy at home, you can go and drop a few bombs on our biggest base in Qatar in the Middle East. And we're not going to retaliate because, you know, we're cooking up this plan. We'll look tough. You'll look tough. We'll all go home and we'll have a ceasefire and that'll stop the war. Now, does that look to you like a country who wants to go to war with Iran? If it wanted to go to war with Iran, it wouldn't be cooking up plans like that. It would just go to war with Iran. So again, it's one of those situations where things are not what they seem. And no, I have no reason at all to, and I've made this point about the whole of the Ukraine war, it'll never happen. We'll never have World War III because the whole point of having nuclear weapons is so we never have World War III. And, you know, and since 1945, that's been the case. And I don't see in any way, shape or form that changing because the United States isn't going to sit there and go, well, the dollar's dead, our empire's dead. Well, let's just go out in a blaze of glory. And no, because that's not the thinking of most people. Yeah, you'll get odd people who think like that, but predominantly it's not the case. And the United States and the Russians are on the phone every day. You know, just keep things ticking over, talking, you know, everything's fine. Yeah, there's a war going on. Yeah, you're arming the Ukrainians. Yeah, we're, you know, it's a very bizarre relationship, but that's how the real world operates. And hence why Putin can meet with Trump and actually gets on with him because, you know, there's a far bigger thing going on and we just, that's how we deal with things. So those back channels are pretty strong and they'll stay strong. And at some point the Ukraine war will end. Everyone will go home. And sadly for the Ukrainians, most of the world will very rapidly forget what happened and they will have to deal with the consequences. And arguably the nation's never going to be the same again. And the devastation is never going to be repaired or fixed.
Well, I think that's a positive thing, but I do agree with your rationalization or your explanation there. And I mean, I think hopeful, I think everybody should be hopeful that, you know, is the outcome. I think, you know, Putin has shown great restraint in retaliation, in being extremely offensive in the Ukraine and, you know, on attacks that have happened within and towards Russia. And I think those are all very positive indications. And I don't think there's ever been a time where we have more ability to communicate, yet at times I think that channel doesn't always seem to be open. And I think Trump has, you know, for all the character flaws that he might have, at least he's trying to talk to these leaders, which seems like, you know, a major change from the last administration. And what is your sense since the Alaskan meeting between Trump and Putin on any ability of peace to be negotiated within the Ukraine conflict?
I think the problem is that, yeah, and I agree, Trump has, I mean, yeah, for all the flaws, at least he has tried to talk to the Russians. I mean, but the US is a complicated beast when it comes to matters pertaining to Russia. As we know, it's not a simple, straightforward, well, I'm the president and this is what's going to happen. I don't doubt The meeting in Alaska was a sobering experience for the Americans. They left the meeting and they were stone-faced. There was no press conference. They were very mute. I mean, Putin did all the talking. Trump basically said, "Hello, how are you?" Yeah, but, and then they went. And the US, there was no fanfare, no nothing, because the US got a brutal dose of reality about the Ukraine war. What's gone on? What actually happened? What the situation is? Trump clearly had no idea what was going on. And that's partly by design. But also, I think also, there's a lot of reasons why the United States in general doesn't understand what's going on. So I think the US thought, again, we can call the shots. We're going to tell Russia this is how the war's ending. And Russia's going, no, that's not how it works. And by the way, we're fighting a war with Ukraine. And, you know, you might be a proxy, but the war's with them. So, you know, the negotiation's with them, not with you. So, you know, we're happy to negotiate, but, you know, but negotiation is based on our core issues. And until they're addressed, the war carries on, and we're nowhere near addressing those core issues. Now, whether people agree with that or not is not the point. Mm-hmm. The Russia will keep the war going irrefutably on that basis, which means they want, you know, no NATO membership. They want neutrality. They want it demilitarized. They want to keep the territory they claim is part of Russia now. Okay, they're all things no one in the West wants to accept. Hey, don't accept it, but don't expect the war to end. And Russia's prepared to keep this war of attrition going for years. I made a rather flippant comment. We could keep this going for 20 years. And don't underestimate the fact they will keep it going for 20 years if they have to, because the war's now not about defeating NATO and defeating what NATO's aspirations were for Ukraine. And in fact, of course, effectively defeating Ukraine. This is now a far more existential problem where they're going, we're at war with the West effectively. So we're going to also, in the process, cause maximum damage to the West. And the Ukraine war's caused immense economic financial problems for the West. I mean, the United States is bankrupt, as, you know, because they are going around the world with a begging bowl. Europe's bankrupt. I mean, the reason they want to look at how they can creatively steal Russia's money in Euroclear is because they're bankrupt. They have nothing, and the war's destroyed them. I mean, allowing Nord Stream pipelines to be blown up has wrecked European economies. Because if you don't have cheap energy, Europe can't function. It's, you know, really basic statement of fact. So Russia will carry on going, well, if you want to keep the war going, you're going to destroy yourself. But the point they keep making is the future's multipolarity, unipolarity is dead. It never really existed. It's over. Well, you have a choice. So in essence, Alaska was nothing really was discussed. Nothing that was going to change anything. And Trump's furious because he thought, I can end the war in a week or a day, or, oh, hang on, I can't now. And no one's listening to me, and he can't handle the fact that he's being just marginalized and the war will carry on. And the Ukrainians are never going to meet the Russians even halfway, and the Russians won't meet the Ukrainians halfway. So the war will carry on, and Europe wants the war to carry on, not because they want to go to war with Russia, but because they've invested so much political capital. If Russia wins the war, they're all finished. Politically, they're all, it's the end of their careers. They're all really, because you can't spend 3.5 years telling everyone in the West, Russia's going to lose the war, we're going to win, we're going to prevail, then we bankrupt ourselves, and Russia still wins. They're, you know, politically, they're finished. So that's why the war has to carry on. And there's some deluded mindset that, well, Russia will eventually lose and they'll capitulate. Oh, that's why Russia's economy is cratering. And apparently all their gas stations are being blown up, which isn't true. And, you know, it's all this just wanting to believe that somehow Ukraine can still win, where anyone who actually admits objectively what's going on knows Ukraine can never win the war. And let's face it, there's a real basic reason why they can't, because if Russia was truly existentially threatened by Ukraine, or by extension, they would then resort to a nuclear war. And that's the one time, and it won't happen, but that's the one time where it could happen. The United States knows this, so they're not going to want to push this too far, which is why the US now wants to walk away and let the Europeans face the music. Say, we did everything we could. We gave you all the weapons. You know, sorry you failed. And just throw the Europeans under the bus, and the Europe's finally realizing that's what Trump's doing. And it's a sensible move for the Americans. Just, you know, blame it on Biden. But, you know, the US isn't really helping itself now because it's still, you know, going to give the Ukrainians weapons, give them intelligence. So in essence, the Trump administration's kind of part of the war also. But they can still walk away from this and feel like, well, we got away with that one, and everyone will forget very quickly that we started this war effectively in 2014 by instigating the Maidan, and the rest is kind of history. But the US wants to get away because they can't face the humiliation that a US-backed proxy war with Russia failed. But Europe's too stupid and will carry on because these politicians go, well, if I haven't got my career, I'm dead and buried. What am I going to do? Stack shelves in a supermarket? Well, they probably wouldn't let me do that unless I was supervised by 10 supervisors. And, you know, because I'm incapable, because these people are completely useless. They shouldn't be anywhere near political office. So they're desperate. And therefore, they will just keep the war going until there is nothing left. So there's no Ukrainians to fight. There's no weapons. There's no money. The country is completely dependent on the West propping it up because it's an economic financial basket case. And that's what happens when you jump into bed with the West, who make you all these promises at a Maidan. Oh, it'll all be great in the future. You can join NATO. You can be part of the EU and you know, and we'll look after you. And look at it. And Ukraine's destroyed. And that's the unforgivable part of the West's role in this. Because they should have long since said to the Ukrainians, it's over. And at one point, the Trump administration did say, you've lost the war. You need to negotiate. But because Trump's Trump and he doesn't want to feel humiliated, he wants to still project this faux strength as though the US is in a position to do anything. The US is in no position to do anything, which is why now they just want to walk away. And it was never their war. Let the Europeans face the music. And then, you know, just get on with whatever, you know, is next on the US docket for, and increasingly they're moving more and more to the Americas and realizing that their global aspirations are over.
You know, Paul, when you're talking about the idea that Russia says that they could string this war out for, what did you say, was another 20 years or something?
Yeah, I think they've probably been a bit flippant. You know, well, maybe not, but they can certainly keep the war going for years. Absolutely.
And, you know, as you're saying that, I was just thinking, like, the Ukraine has lost so many soldiers in that war. Like, what would they possibly have left? And that just, you know, obviously it's a flippant statement, but you know, it just comes back to the incentives of this war. It seems like hubris. It seems like the West, or, you know, if you want to call it NATO, Zelensky, whoever you want to point the finger at, like, what is the point of continuing this war? Why don't we take the people out of the meat grinder, accept that Russia, or accept maybe the miscalculation that they came into this war with, and just move forward in a positive way? Like, I just don't understand, other than from the, let's say, the neocon perspective of having profitable war, what the point of this is.
Well, the issue is that the feeling in Europe and the United States is if Russia wins the war, it's the end of NATO. And it probably is. And because, you know, and also the fear is if in European, like the Baltic Republics and Poland, if Russia wins and defeats Ukraine, Putin wants the Soviet Union 2.0, which they don't. Why do they want these countries? Absolutely not. But they think they do. And they're all suffering from Cold War PTSD. There's people there who grew up under Soviet occupation, and it still gives them nightmares. And they think Russia's coming back for more, so they defeat Ukraine. Then they'll come for the Baltic republics, because they actually know Article 5 and NATO's meaning is the US is never going to war with Russia unless Russia bombs the United States, which it never will do. And they know that, therefore, they're terrified. And they legitimately think Russia's coming for them next as well as all the political capital I've invested. So they just have to keep the war going. The United States, of course, doesn't want to appear to be the nation that, well, because you refused to support Ukraine, Ukraine lost the war, because that would be immensely damaging for their credibility in NATO, because the US, in a way, wants NATO to continue, because it's a mechanism to control Europe. Because ultimately, the United States' biggest fear is Europe integrates into the multipolar world and becomes part of Greater Eurasia, that stretches from Portugal, in the west, to Vladivostok in the east. So they don't want NATO to be destroyed. So, and therefore, if the US was seen to be, or could be blamed for why, because they just walked away and said, we're not supporting this anymore, then, so the US doesn't want the war to end on that basis, but the US wants out of it, but they want NATO to survive. They want the Europeans to buy, you know, huge, you know, amount more arms, increase spending to 5% of GDP, which will destroy all these economies, but let's not worry about the maths again. So that's the bottom line. So if the fear is that great about Russia winning for those reasons, that's why they don't want the war to end. There are people who really think that the Europeans want to go to war with Russia. Directly, they don't. The Poles admitted, oh, we came up with all these stories. We're just trying to unnerve the Russians. It failed, and we admit we're not doing it. Because they can't. I mean, Poland's got a huge army, but you know what? It would last 2 days. In a war against Russia. That's enough for about 3 or 4 days of munitions, then it's out. So what kind of war is it going to fight? It's not going to fight a war. Europe is also not going to have a war which is conventional with Russia. It will go straight to a nuclear strike, and it'll be all over in 15 minutes, and Europe will cease to exist. And people know this. So again, we have to be careful between what people say and the reality they understand. But this is the absurdity that when you invest that much political capital and your ideological hatred of Russia and particularly Putin, then you just have to keep going because you think, well, we're destroyed, you know, we're finished. So we just keep going and hope for a miracle, hope that somehow Russia can lose. You know, and that's the desperation because, you know, these people are not very bright. They're not intelligent enough to use your reasoning and say, it's over. Look, we need to do our best. This is how you would do. You'd go, look, we gave Ukraine everything we could. They just weren't good enough. They can blame Ukraine for the failure. Just blame Zelensky. But they're too stupid to realize they can put it all on Zelensky and walk away from this. But also it's because of the pathological fear that Russia will come for them next. And of course, Russia's never going to do that. I mean, it's a huge landmass. It doesn't need to be taking more countries. I mean, there's no need to do this, and there's no benefit to doing it. But if you suffer from Cold War PTSD and you're terrified of Russia, and let's face it, the Soviet Union was hardly nice during these countries' occupation, you can understand where it comes from. But Russia is not the Soviet Union anymore. It's not Stalin. It's not any of the former leadership of that country. It's changed. I mean, okay, you know, they're at war with Russia indirectly or really to all intents and purposes. I mean, it's a proxy war and, well, because there are not NATO forces in Ukraine, but there's been these military personnel and advisors and other people in there since 2014 in various guises. So it is a bit more than a proxy war in the strict sense of the word. But, you know, rational thinking doesn't apply in the West anymore. We don't think rationally. We don't understand that the longer this war drags on, the outcome for us as well is going to be even worse and more devastating. And, you know, it's one thing losing a war and losing political face, but it's another thing wrecking your economy and financial system. in the process.
Paul, something that I want to get your take on, and, you know, specifically in that financial system arena, we've seen the rise in Thailand and Vietnam of these basically digital ID and exclusion and closing of millions of bank accounts if you're not complying with the digital ID requirements. We've seen Starmer come out in the UK talking about digital ID as a necessity to, you know, be in the workforce. Do you think that this is, you know, just showing us the trajectory of a growing trend within, let's call it the West, of a move towards digital ID and digital banking?
You know, it's a very, this is a very emotive subject amongst people, and I try to cut the emotion out of it. It's difficult with people. I totally understand where people are coming from, but, you know, I'm going to start with this basic premise. We already all, most of us anyway, in the Western world, have a digital bank account anyway. Okay? And if the government wants to freeze our assets, they can apply for a court order and do it in the blink of an eye. No problem. So why do they need to give us another digital bank account to cut us off from a digital bank account? They don't. They can do it with your existing bank account. So giving you another bank account isn't going to change that. Do they already have mass surveillance of people? Absolutely, dude. They have all the information they need on every person. So another ID isn't going to change that. It might be more formalized, but nothing's changed. You know, it's like in the Netherlands, you have this digital ID, which allows you to access all these website, government websites under one umbrella. It's very, very convenient for people. But it's a form of ID. Does it change anybody's life? No. Now, I'm not saying there isn't a risk in the future that things could be radically different. But at the end of the day, why? Let's go back to the pandemic. People were adamant that when they started locking us down, we're all locked down forever. This is the new normal. Well, it never transpired. I kept saying, don't be ridiculous. Do you not understand what locking the entire world down is going to mean? It will destroy the entire economy. And these billionaires are only rich off the backs of you and I because we buy their goods and services. And we're not buying them anymore. They're not billionaires anymore. They're finished. They're not going to wreck their own gravy tray. And lo and behold, it's what the new normal never happened and the old normal returned. So, you know, I think there's a lot of fear in this that is based on people making assumptions about what a digital ID means. I mean, this idea, well, they can force you to spend all the money at a given period of time. Do you know where that story came from? It was China. China had the digital yuan. They were doing pilot testing and telling people, you've got to spend this money in X number of days because we want to road test the platform to see if it can handle the throughput of transactions in a short space of time. That's where the idea came from. Well, China's doing it first. They're the blueprint because, you know, there's a world government and there's no world government. And China's part of it because the world government's moving from the West to the East and China's going to control it. So China's going to be the first country because, you know, they're a totalitarian dictatorship where they lock everyone up all the time, which of course is nonsense as well. And all these stories about a digital currency or ID came from the basis of what people perceived was going on in China, their social credit system. Guess what? For people, it doesn't exist. It's a myth. It's another Western nonsense that never has any basis in reality. So a lot of this is based on people being fearful of something they think is real. But let's imagine they do decide to just cut everyone off from their bank and restrict what you can spend your money on. And you can only do this once a week. And how long do they think the economy and a financial system is going to function on that basis? The whole lot will blow up in 24 hours to 48. It'll all be gone. The West has spent since 2008 trying to prevent that happening. Why would they go and destroy their entire financial system? Why would these super rich people that everyone thinks controls the world, and that's highly debatable, but let's work on the basis they think all these people do. Well, if we're not consuming the stuff they sell, then they're bust as well. They have nothing. Do you think they're going to destroy their own empire? No. So people need to understand what putting these restrictions in place are going to do. And, you know, if you have a digital bank account now, they can do it. So why? Tell me how many people you know who've had their bank accounts cut off. There's odd people, but generally no one. Why? Because they don't care about you and I. People have this very inflated opinion that I'm so important that they're going to come and look at my what I've been shopping this week and tell me I can't do this and they're going to cut me off. Now, I don't doubt there has been worrying developments with regards to things, with particularly in the UK, where people have been worried about comments that are made and things are being followed. I'm not disputing that. It's got nothing to do with a digital ID. I understand why people have concerns about it, but my own personal philosophy on this is that I don't see this as changing anything. I think all the problems that people believe this will cause already are in place and exist, and they have been for a very, very long time. I mean, at one point, it would have just been paper-based records. Now it's electronic records. That all the details people think they're going to have in the future, they already have on people. So why does it make any difference? Why do they want to lock up the world like apparently they were going to do during the pandemic? Well, they're not going to do this. A lot of this is just fear-based, and there are people out there who actually have a desire to drive massive fear into people and scare the hell out of them because they get a kick out of it. And, you know, people being terrified, you have a captive audience. And once you drive fear into them, very difficult for that fear to go away. Now, I'm not being blasé and naive and saying there aren't possibly risks associated with things. But I live on the basis of realities and not on the basis that I'm going to spend my entire life being fearful of something that never happens. Hence, when the pandemic happened, I never once went, well, this is our life forever now. And, well, of course, at some point it's going to have to end. The reason it had to end is because you couldn't economically function as a country. You couldn't, in any way, shape, or form, have a financial system that would have survived what that carrying on forever and a day. So people need to look at the reality of what they think is going to happen and what it means in the real world. And, you know, if you have whatever the digital ID is in the UK is not yet clear. So the question, therefore, on that basis is what they're saying it means. It proves you can have a right to work in the United Kingdom. Does it really change anything as things stand because you have a national insurance number there? The answer is no. Now, if it's just that, well, how's that going to be used to control people? But then people go, but that's just the start. They're going to do all these other things. And my question to them is, how do you know this? Tell me on what basis you make this decision. Well, they make it because they heard a million other people say, or 50 other people, and then it becomes an established fact in their mind. And a lot of people live in constant states of fear. And the fear is not justified or a reality. So, yes, I'd be the first to say, with regards to what they're proposing in the UK, well, here's another problem. There was a big move pushing people in the UK to make a big deal about immigration. And I remember saying at the time, be careful what you do because there will be consequences way above what you think. And one of the consequences of people making a big deal about it is they've now gone, well, we need an ID card that proves people have a legitimate right to live and work in the UK. Well, that's a consequence of people making a big song and dance about something now. I'm not saying there aren't immigration issues. Of course there is. But a lot of the stuff that's going out there is just ridiculously out of control, is not an accurate representation of problems. And, you know, people are now starting to go, oh, hang on. So I made a big deal about this, and now this gets rolled out. Now, what happens next if people have a right to be concerned about things and to make representation? I'm not saying people should just say absolutely nothing about things, but be very careful who is instigating all these problems that exist to do with immigration in the UK. There is something rather insidious going on there. that, and there is a deliberate intention to cause maximum amount of problems, and it's by design. It's, they're not there to say there's a legitimate problem and we need to do something else. There are people who want to cause huge societal unrest in the likes of the UK, because what could that lead to? I mean, and, you know, so we have to be extremely careful how we understand what's going on. But am I on a personal basis particularly concerned about it at this point in time? No. I will deal with realities rather like the pandemic. I will deal with what happens, and nothing transpired that people said. Okay, maybe this could be different, but don't live your life on the basis, well, this is just the start of something, because that's what people said in the pandemic. Oh, remember they in the UK, they started to relax lockdowns a bit. Oh, they're just giving us the summer off. Oh, look, the winter's back. Oh, see, we're being locked down again. And then when it all died, there'll be another virus coming on. Oh, look, it's monkeypox. And monkeypox came and went, oh. And there's people just trying to justify their position by trying to find any spurious reason to convince themselves that their state of fear is reality. Why would anybody want to do that? Just accept there are things about the pandemic that are clearly extremely concerning, but don't continue to hold on to a belief because you decided that someone told you this was what's going to happen. It's going to happen. They lock us all down and put massive restrictions. That is going to completely destroy Western countries. And the one thing, if you want to control people, you give them enough to make them not realize they are being controlled. If you take away those things, you risk upsetting the masses. And the last thing anybody wants to do is upset the masses of a country, because they have no way of understanding how they're going to react to that, which is why we already have a digital bank account. They can do whatever they want. They can cut you off tomorrow. So why aren't you focusing on that rather than focusing on they're going to give me a digital bank account, which, by the way, is not going to be mandatory. You can only transfer so much money into a digital central bank digital currency, because you can't take all your money out of a traditional bank, because your core bank runs and blow up the financial system. People don't seem to be aware of that either. And there is no compulsion to use this. And the reason is a lot of banks don't want it. Believe it or not, some of the biggest people complaining about it is the current existing financial system and existing banks, who are really concerned about what the impact's going to be on them. So it's not a clear-cut story. It's not like all these other ideas about who runs the world. There's these entities and they control everything, and there's a secret one world government that includes Xi and Putin. Really, is that why they're at war with Russia and trying to get rid of Putin? Is that part of the plan? Oh yeah, that's a 4D chess move. It's all to deceive you and make you think they're on opposite sides, but they're all concocting to bring in this one world governance maximum Orwellian state surveillance. I'm sorry, but, you know, and the basic bottom line is that's just a very childish response to a very far more complex problem. Chinese and the Russians are not on anyone's side, one world governance or otherwise, and they want to usher in a completely new world. And that's caused immense problems for those people spreading this nonsense, because they're then trying to still convince people that China and Russia are part of this. Well, they've got a pretty funny way of showing that they're part of some grand conspiracy.
Well, I appreciate that, you know, that sober look. And I do agree with a lot of those ideas that, you know, a lot of these control systems are already in place. And it just, it's a good reminder to understand what systems already exist, right? And again, going back to this idea of making it be very sober is quite important to be able to remember at this time.
Yeah, look, as I say, they exist. I mean, the problem's already there. Surveillance already exists, and the ability, if they want to cut people out of financial system or whatever, but they don't do it. And that's the point people need to understand. Bringing in these new technologies isn't going to change anything. And that really is the point people need to focus on. The fact that no one seems to be aware of the fact that problems like this are already in place potentially is the thing I find quite interesting, because people should understand, what do you think your bank account is? Why do they think that is going to be so radically different to this new? Oh, because a central bank controls it? Well, that's like saying central banks control the world. It's like the United States. The Fed is controlled by the ESF in the United States. That is the thing people are never told. They're always told, oh, the Fed controls the world. No, it doesn't. The ESF controls the Fed, which is why when they had gold confiscation, where did the gold end up? It ended up at the newly created ESF, and it stayed there. Well, maybe it isn't there, but as far as official records go, the ESF took the gold. So who does that tell you is running the show? It's not the Fed. So people need to be very careful in the things they believe and how the world operates. I'm not saying the world is a perfect place and it's full of, it's all, you know, roses in the garden and or any of that nonsense. I'm absolutely not, but be very careful the stuff you believe that people are telling you, which is, and we're back to this point of entertaining people, there are far more serious problems in the world that these people never talk about. And the reason they don't, so they don't have a clue what really goes on. So, you know, rather like a lot of these things, if you start to think about it and look at it in stark reality, understand how the financial system works, how economies work, then you'd realize that they're not going to, you know, cook the goose. They want to just keep benefiting. So they want us to buy all this stuff we don't need, because they profit and make huge sums of money and they want to benefit from that. They're not going to make us destitute and serfs, because what are they going to be? Are they going to control a kingdom of serfs? How? How exactly is that going to work? And how does that benefit them? It doesn't. They want, you know, they want to be filthy rich and have lots of money and power. Well, they're not going to have anything. If we're all, because do they really think the serfs in the 21st century are going to sit there and tolerate it? Absolutely not. And they're terrified of upsetting the masses too much for that very reason. So give them enough to keep them happy so they don't think their digital bank account's a problem. So they don't think we have this surveillance and we have all these records on people. Just don't let them ever think that. Then they'll be very happy. So why would they then want to roll out something that actually was something that, over and above what they already have? And when do they ever implement these things? That's there as a, well, if someone becomes a real problem, we have a way of tracking them down and knowing where they are. But by and large, all of us are so, have such boring and interesting lives. Who cares which supermarket I go out? I bought some kitchen appliance, ironically, today. Do they really think they're interested in that? Please, people need to get over themselves and stop thinking they're so important that the state's watching them. I mean, that's the classic paranoia and fear-induced nonsense, and people need to step away from it, because when you're sucked into that world, it's very different to get out. It's very difficult to get out of it, and it makes people fundamentally very unhappy. And I think there's enough in the world to be concerned about without being unhappy about something that has no real basis in your life on a day-to-day basis.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I actually know a lady that had her bank accounts closed. And like I personally know her in Canada here. And, you know, it can happen. It is a possibility. But it's, you know, I've spoken about this before and I made a speech about it. Is like, you know, why would you put all your eggs in one basket? You know, if this is a possibility, which, you know, as remote as it might be, there's always that possibility, then why not think of ways, you know, to take some of that autonomy back and think about solutions around that problem by opening other bank accounts, by dealing with not just one financial institution, by not just holding all of your cash in one bank account. You know, diversification of risk is another excellent strategy to deal with a lot of these problems. You know, having other forms of money other than the currency that you deal in the most. Like there are solutions to these problems. And as you so rightly put, it's important to not just focus on the problem. Let's think about solutions. And many of these problems are, you know, many times just blown way out of proportion.
Yeah, so yeah, I mean, you're absolutely correct. And I mean, you're the person you're speaking to. Yeah, it does happen. And we're not going to get into discussing why that, because that's just totally inappropriate. But the point is, just because it happened, that it's extremely unfortunate when it happens to someone for whatever reason. But it's not something that universally happens. I mean, and we also, you know, we can't sit there and go, well, something happened once. Therefore, that means it's likely to happen to me in the future. That's not how people should live their lives. And people should, yeah, make provision if they can and look at alternatives. But just understand the fact that you have, without really laboring the point too much, you have a digital bank account. You can be cut off from it. And it's very easy to do it. Ask yourself, why have they never done it in the whole of your life? And it's horrendous when it happens to an individual, but they're very much in an incredibly small minority, given the amount of bank accounts and people who live in a country. It's fractions and fractions of 1%. So why do they need to invent something else to, and it's all, as I said, this idea has all come out of China. Because there's this idea, and I've seen all this stuff in very disreputable publications and sites and channels going, they're going to do this because China's the started this whole digital currency, and this is they're the basis. It's a world plan. Every country's going to do it. So what they're doing in China, they're going to do in the rest of the world. Well, half of the things they claim China's doing aren't true. No one has to use the digital yuan in any way, shape, or form. It's a possibility. It's something that people can utilize if they want to. But there's no compulsion to do so. So try and deal with what actually happens, as opposed to this fear that you think something's going to happen. That's not the basis to live your life.
I wholeheartedly agree with that. And again, it kind of goes back to this idea of do something about it instead of just worrying about it. Paul, I want to thank you for, you know, taking a lot of time to explain your viewpoint on all of these things to help us try to triangulate where we are in the world based on different voices and different pieces of information. You know, again, going back to this idea of where China actually sits, what the actual, you know, problems are there. Let's say, you know, for example, the social credit system, it's something that I think we need to be talking about and really trying to get a handle on a lot of the fear porn that exists within a lot of these channels. And it's not necessarily good for everybody, but, you know, unfortunately, some people do kind of gravitate to that, and I think we need to be focusing on solutions rather than just the problems. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we wrap up here?
Just to echo your point, you know, look, just think about things more. Don't get into a heightened state of emotion when thinking about what's happening, and because the risk is then you will start to gravitate to things that frankly, are not good for your well-being. And, you know, I'm happy to have a discussion, excuse me, in a broader sense about this whole thing with digital IDs or whatever. But a lot of people, you can't discuss it with them because they've already made up their mind what it means. And then if I don't agree with them, well, you must be part of the problem. You know, you're part of the trouble. You know, I can't trust you either. I mean, this is just extremely unhelpful. I'm not disputing that surveillance exists. It exists in a far bigger way than people realize. And, you know, but let's not pretend that something new is coming out, and it's absolutely devastating because we've all lived under this utopian existence before this apparently new thing is a major problem. That, you know, is the bottom line. But the fear of repeating myself, but just, you know, and I, you know, the final point I'd like to make is obviously from Tom's perspective, I really wish him the best. I think the channel will succeed, but we'd really be thrilled when it does. And we look forward to coming back in the future. And please support Tom, because he's a good guy and he really means well. And this channel deserves to be successful. So everyone, pull your finger out and help him.
Well, I appreciate that very much, Paul. And for anybody that wants to check out more of your work, that's all available at the Sirius, S-I-R-I-U-S, report.com, as well as at the Sirius Report on X. Paul, thanks so much for your time today.
A pleasure as ever.